Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking once again with Donna Sabella. Donna is a mental health nurse and assistant clinical professor and director of global studies at the Drexel University College of Nursing and Health Professions in Philadelphia. And Donna also coordinates AJN's Mental Health Matters column. So welcome, Donna. Nice to talk to you again.
As always, nice to talk to you, Sean.
So Donna has written an article that we have in our January issue called Mental Health and Violence, and it explores what role, if any, does mental illness play in the U.S.'s very high homicide rate, and our firearm homicide rates are almost 20 times higher than those in Italy, Japan, Portugal, France, Germany, and Austria. So one must pause and wonder why it's just so different here in the U.S. Would be wonderful if this column had the exact answer.
Exactly. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me for why that is true.
But in the column, Donna explores some of the violent episodes that have been sadly in the news recently in the last year or so. Columbine, it was several years ago, and then, of course, there was Gabrielle Giffords' shooting. And then last year, more recently, the horrific shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And in retrospect, it's easy to look at some of these incidences and the shooters and say, well, yeah, obviously this person had problems and there were some incidences along the way. And some people were known to have some issues that had been dealt with. But it's always kind of from a retrospective point. And one of the things that the media reports of these incidents do is I think they then put out this false perception among the public that, you know, anyone with mental health issues is probably going to be violent. And that's a big misperception, correct?
It is a current misperception, mm-hmm. But it is incorrect. In that, and I think the history of people with mental illness has long been, you know, one of kind of people are dangerous, they're violent, they're lunatics, they need to be. I think the early treatment of people, you know, a decade ago was to sort of lock them up. So, I mean, I think that still exists, and in part the media sort of keeps playing on that, realizing, too, in some centers, in some areas, people still do very much believe that. And there's a certain level of fear, you know, what do you say to someone who has mental health issues, and what do I do, and you know, are they going to hurt me? So, I mean, I think that pretty much sums up at least what many, many people think in this country and elsewhere.
Yeah. And yet, when you look at some of the statistics of just how prevalent mental illness is in this country, and you know, defining mental illness in the broadest terms from, you know, being depressed to anxiety syndromes, et cetera, probably there's no family that doesn't have somebody who would fit into some category. So people should have an awareness that not all mentally, that people with mental health issues are violent. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
No, exactly. And as you pointed out, I mean, you know, what is mental illness? There's a whole range and a long continuum of, you know, from maybe someone being anxious, which in many cases is normal. You know, you're taking an exam or you're driving in the snow today, you're going to be anxious. Mm-hmm. Are you mentally ill? You know, folks who are depressed, if you've just lost a spouse or a significant other or a child, you know, you're going to be depressed. You know, there's one end of the spectrum all the way up to what many people think of first when they think of mental illness is psychosis, and someone who's lost touch with reality, who, you know, has trouble making sense when they speak, who has delusions and loose associations and all those sort of things. But again, even there at that end of the continuum, most people who have mental illness or who have some sort of behavioral, you know, issue are not any more violent than the general public. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm anxious, I'm not really interested necessarily in hurting someone. If I'm depressed, you know, I usually turn that inward, and we talk about the very fact that we're concerned with suicide means that much of that is directed toward the individual, him or herself, and not towards someone else. And even someone who's psychotic or schizophrenic has, you know, is oftentimes victimized themselves. And if people know how to sort of work around some of that, I never get into someone's space who might feel threatened or paranoid. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when staff or other people are hurt, sometimes, you know, if I think you're out to get me and you're right in my space and in my face, I'm going to protect myself. So, you know, when we do hear some of those instances, sometimes they can be explained by that I'm feeling mm-hmm. threatened, and you just don't know how to keep some distance and maybe lower your voice and be calm and reassuring.
And it's a matter of the person not knowing that this person has these issues.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, people, and even the most psychotic individual will have episodes of clarity and kind of realize, you know, that maybe I don't want to be telling people some of my delusions, and because I know it's going to get me in trouble. So on the outside for a while, particularly when the mental illness is starting to develop and progress and hasn't reached full steam, at that point I might just try to keep some of this to myself. I mean, we look at Holmes in his doctoral program, obviously kept it together well enough to get into the program.
Holmes, the young man who shot up the Colorado movie theater.
Yes. Mm-hmm, yes. So, you know, he was in a very intense doctoral program. So, you know, at some point people keep it together until they start falling apart. As you just said, sometimes it's not always so obvious. Mm-hmm. But in his case, it was. I mean, according to what we were reading in the paper, the psychiatrist with whom he was working expressed some concern. That's clue number one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something should have been done right then and there to stop some of this. And I think he was reaching out.
In just talking about that point that you just said about realizing there was some issues, because you may realize that, you know, wow, this person has some issues, they're reclusive. For example, Adam Lanza, he was, you know, living with his mother, he didn't have a job, by all accounts, he stayed in his room with the shades down, and, you know, so there were clearly people had identified him as, you know, someone different. So what can you do, though? I mean, it doesn't seem that he was in treatment. I guess having treatment available is step number one.
Yes.
And that's probably a big issue for most people, especially adolescents who often fall through the insurance cracks.
Right, and I think, and again, you know, I wasn't there. I wasn't in the house. We only know what we know through what we've read. But again, yes, it was so much of a concern about him to the point of, you know, his not being in school. What concerns me is that there was never any signs of any him having been assessed, treated, evaluated, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a red flag. If the parent, you know, he's at home with his mother, who's so concerned about his behavior. If someone doesn't want to go to get treatment, I mean, we do have, and we use it judiciously and with love and with kindness, but people can, and I don't like this word, but they can be committed mm-hmm. and sort of taken into treatment to get at least evaluation on a short-term basis. And, you know, who knows if that had happened with Adam Lanza, some of this might have been prevented mm-hmm. because there were certainly years of concern over his behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, you know, we all love our children and want to, even if there's a problem, try to work with them. But I have sons. If I were concerned about either one of them and their behavior to the extent that they were locking themselves in their room, et cetera, I would not be giving them a gun or even keep guns in the house mm-hmm. Under lock and key away from them. I just, you know, that is not recommended approach to this mm. sort
and
of thing.
Are there any red flags, you know, for example, There was one woman who whose son had shot someone, and I can't remember her name. And she wrote, it was very widely given a lot of play on the internet. And she wrote a letter to Adam Lanza's mother as a mother who had a son who had committed some violence, and detailed in it her attempts to get her son help and how, you know, he went to the waiting list at this place was very long, or they gave him medication that was difficult for him to take because of side effects and stuff. And she was worried that something was going to happen, and she told people this. And it sounded like this mother went, you know, just tried to get him help, couldn't get him help, tried to alert people that, you know, she was so worried about her son doing something to himself or others, and yet, and he did eventually. But are there any, like, she obviously saw the patterns in her son, but when people evaluated and perhaps, you know, just briefly didn't see some of what she had been seeing on an ongoing basis. But are there some red flags that, that kind of people should just really pay attention to?
Oh, certainly. If you read the column, there are a number of them in there. But I certainly see a change in behavior. Certainly the clearest thing is if, you know, you're going to be sorry, I start threatening people. Mm-hmm. Because people really go from zero to, you know, extremely violent and aggressive in 2 seconds. It's usually some sort of warning signs along the way. Personality change, I feel threatened. Usually the pattern here, we're profiling now, but it's usually young, white male. Mm-hmm. So if that increases the risk factor, if your loved one falls into that category, substance abuse tends to put, forget mental illness aside, but you know, substance abuse, add to that, increases the risk that someone might do something violent. Having firearms, being extremely angry, maybe starting to not pay attention to my personal hygiene, loss of interest in some things, feeling threatened, having some delusions. You know, there's a whole number of things that would raise my concern over someone's behavior. Now, again, most of the time, people sort of, okay, you'll get better, you know, and then they don't have to intervene to the extent that might have been necessary in some of the cases that are highlighted in the column. But, you know, if any of these things occur, it certainly is worthy of following up, calling a mental health association, calling NAMI, calling, you know, if you have, there's public clinics. Even if someone has no insurance, if one of my sons, let's say, or my daughter were to have some of this behavior and be actually threatening, I know people don't like to do this, but one can call the police, mm-hmm. and they will come and do something. And people can be committed without insurance. Take someone to the hospital emergency room. They're equipped to deal with this and mm-hmm. find appropriate treatment for the individual. Or if they have a psychiatric unit in the hospital, they can, you know, actually hold them for a while and get them there. And if the person then agrees to treatment, they can convert it to a voluntary, what we call a voluntary commitment, and agree to stay to get some evaluation. Mm-hmm. So there are, again, as you say, I mean, sometimes it's not easy. A couple of times people will go to clinics and treat, be assessed, et cetera, and then be discharged. And that's sort of, you know, they read that in these articles. The shooter in Virginia Tech had been in treatment there, had been seen, and then had been released. Maybe we shouldn't release people so soon. So, again, you know, we have to sort of take these factors into account mm-hmm. and do a thorough job in assessing someone. Mm-hmm. Do we have a crystal ball? No, you know. So many people are assessed and then let go and go home and do nothing,
right?
You know, and get better.
We hear about the ones that go on, and there's probably, you know, a vast majority, as you said, that, you know, are having some kind of a crisis, and they go and they get medication or whatever, and then, you know, do all right once they're on medication.
Yes, and I think, too, I mean, the cases that are highlighted in the column, mm-hmm. Pretty much... There were issues before any of this happened. There were some warning signs in all of the people that I wrote about. So, again, it's not a question of, oh, you know, geez, this came out of the blue. Where did this come from? There were indications before this happened.
Right.
Some of them mild. I mean, in the Columbine, they found some diary writings, et cetera, and, you know, kind of nothing stood out per se to the extent maybe with Holmes kind of, you know, his psychiatrist being concerned about him. But there were still issues. So, again, there were some warning signs.
Right. And I guess it's, again, having somebody who is astute enough to realize that, you know, things are just tipping, continually tipping towards, well, I guess an analogy would be for a person who's going to commit suicide. You know, there's, people say, oh, gee, they seem so happy, they seem so whatever, you know, and yet you look and they say, well, yeah, they weren't happy, and now all of a sudden they are happy.
Exactly,
you know?
You're right.
And that whole idea of having, you know, like if their standard mode of operation is at a certain level of, you know, unhappiness or dysfunction or kind of muddling around, but then all of a sudden there's a change, it's that change thing that kind of should make you notice that, well, what's going on here?
Right, that's certainly, and for people who don't know, you know, exactly, with suicide, you think, oh, people get really depressed. But what we believe is that oftentimes once I make up my mind to commit suicide, then that improves my mood, and then there'll be a change, which again, sometimes it's hard to tell, because if I'm on medication, too, the antidepressants kick in, then I am going to start to feel better. So which is it? Have I made up my mind to do something to myself, to hurt myself? Or is it the medication working? So, again, I mean, this is, you know, the families and the lay are the first line of defense, but then it's really important to follow up with a professional. And also, I mean, I appreciate family members' issues that they're dealing with, because mental health has such a stigma, a negative stigma associated with it, that I don't, you know, do I want to call the police on my own child and have this, you know, that's a hard call to make. Many people wouldn't want to do that because of the stigma. But then even then, if you do, if there's no bed space, I live in a wealthy county, and we only have one hospital with one unit. Another hospital closed the unit for mental health. So, you know, we're finding fewer beds. We're finding, you know, longer waiting lines. We're talking about now the veterans coming back with all sorts of issues. There's, you know, in need of treatment, and we need more mental health professionals. We need to make access to mental health treatment more easy, more affordable, and you know, kind of, I think, to do a better job, too, in our society in terms of what we think and how we treat folks who have problems. Because, you know, many of us will be there at some point in our lives, and it's not the end of the world. People do get better. There is treatment out there, but we need to, from our end, too, the healthcare provision area, improve what we offer.
Well, when one thinks that, you know, given the amount of diabetes and heart disease, and then you look at the amount of mental health or mental illness, which, you know, and again, it's an illness, many times with roots that are, you know, often in traumatic events in childhood or PTSD, but it is an illness, and yet, you know, we wouldn't think of not treating people with diabetes or heart disease, and yet we don't have those capacities available for people with mental illness.
Exactly, even though we're supposed to, with the parity.
Well, I was just going to ask you, do you think that Mental Health Parity Act will, I guess if there's no money behind it, it's not going to make much of a difference, but it at least there's a statute now that seems to, that people will have to improve the insurance for these, for treatment.
Exactly, and, you know, there's no money. I mean, we have money for a lot of other things, that, you know, that there should be money made for this, because, you know, it's we'd be hard-pressed to find someone who's not in need of some sort of treatment or a helping hand. It's penny-wise and pound-foolish, I guess, or however the saying goes, you know, not to prevent, because we come in after the fact. So look at the lives lost in Colorado. Look at the damage done. Look at the cost now of the court, of the apartment that was, you know, rigged, of the loss to the families. For all of this, how much is that in terms of both financial and non-financial loss? If this could have been prevented, you know, with a couple $1,000 more of treatment or something, it certainly is well worth it. And until we do something about it, and, you know, and again, with the shooting at the Navy Yard, how much would it have cost to say, all right, this man has a problem, something's going on, let's take his weapon from him? What would that have cost?
Yes,
you know, some common sense.
Yeah, some basic approaches to treatment of people, especially people who've been in the military who are so familiar with how to use weapons, and many of them have their own weapons.
Yes,
certainly. On National Public Radio today, they profiled a young man who had PTSD and was diagnosed with PTSD while he was just back from Iraq. And while he was still in the service, had an incident that caused him to be arrested, so he was received a dishonorable discharge. And because of that, he's not eligible for benefits. So he cannot go to the VA to get treated for the PTSD that caused the problem for which he was discharged. So it sounds like there's a whole circle that is just this, people get trapped in. And when one thinks of all these young men and women who you know, are being diagnosed, or maybe not being diagnosed because then that there's an onus to treat, that are coming back from these wars and needing help, but are, the system just is set up so that they can't get it. We really do need to fix this somehow.
Exactly, and it's a simple fix. I mean, it's a catch-22, and it's just actually it's insane that you know that the military would allow this to happen to a veteran that he's evidencing and showing signs of behavior probably you know related to a service-related injury, and then because of that he's going to be punished and not be able to be given the treatment by them. So you know, and when his money runs out for paying for it out of his pocket, what do we think is going to happen next? You know, the possibility exists that if the PTSD isn't taken care of and treated, that the next time he won't stop before he realizes what's going on, and someone's going to get seriously hurt or die.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's an instance where, you know, the military should step in and say, we expect this is going to happen with our returning veterans. We expect that because of the trauma that they are experiencing, that they are going to do things which are not good, and therefore we need to help them and treat them for this.
Well, I hope the. I think there was a press release a couple of weeks ago that the VA was hiring thousands of mental health workers. So hopefully that indicates a real effort to address these issues.
Well, that I mean, I must say that that's been in the news for a while. I worked at a VA in my area, and I have a friend who works at the VA in Philadelphia. A couple of colleagues. They've not yet hired people, and one of the things too is that. And any of the nursing positions where they were using advanced practice nurses to work with the veterans and do counseling, they're tending to be replaced by psychologists, et cetera, which are more expensive. There's certainly more nurses. So I certainly hope to see that, you know, we are bringing in more clinical nurse specialists to do counseling and work with the veterans, also nurse practitioners, psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners, to do this, and that we actually start hiring people soon.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for taking the time to provide a little bit more background. The column, as I indicated earlier, it's a mental health and mental illness and violence is in our January issue. You can read it in print or online or on your iPad. And thank you again, Donna, for providing a bit more context.
You're welcome. My pleasure. And I just want to say in parting that as of now, the one-year anniversary is coming up for the Sandy Hook Elementary
right.
School. Mission. So again, you know, just we'll be hearing more about that certainly before the column comes out, and maybe even when it comes out. So just you know, reflect back on some of this, and this wasn't the last example of this until we maybe make some changes in helping people and doing a better job of that. I hope so. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome.